Hi, I'm Naomi. I'm 37 and a new mum. And when I was on the fence about becoming a parent, all I heard was, but without it, you won't know true love. Now I've got a baby though, all I hear is, you think this newborn phase is tricky, you just wait till they're crawling. Now, despite deciding to baby, there's still loads more to find out from both camps. So here's a podcast on the Secret Recordings Network where I chat to baby wanters, baby rejecters and everything in between to see why we decide to baby or not to baby. In this episode, I chat to Sheridan, who experienced male infertility.
You might have night after night after night that you are holding your sobbing wife because this is a really difficult journey and you're the biological reason why she can't have what she wants.
And I'm joined on this journey by my sister and best friend, Camilla. How's it going?
Oh, good, thanks. That was very sprightly.
I thought I'd ask how you were because I know you always are awkward around the hello.
I was getting slight anxiety when it was coming up to the thing, like, oh God, how am I going to say it this week? Hi. Hi, guys. I'm back. Oh, me again.
So I saved you that.
Oh, thanks.
But also it's common courtesy when someone asks how you are to ask the other person back.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Flustered. How are you?
Not great. So before we recorded this podcast, I just had to have a little cry on Camilla. So I'm feeling a bit better than I was before. And I almost feel guilty having any kind of moans about being a mum because we're about to go into an interview that is about infertility. And so I hope this doesn't come across as in any way disrespectful of that. But I am struggling a bit at the minute. One of the reasons that I wanted to talk about it is because when the first episode of the podcast had come out, someone said to me, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, you're smashing motherhood and a podcast. I'm paraphrasing. That wasn't the comment on Instagram. But basically, people have said that to me and I don't feel like that. And don't get me wrong, there are days that I do feel like that. So you're catching me on a bad day. Apologies in advance. But I am finding it really difficult juggling being a mum, having a radio show. Two radio shows, in fact, a week, doing a writing job, which I'm still doing bits of, and doing a podcast, to the point where I am having sleepless nights thinking, oh my God, I've not put anything on the To Baby or Not To Baby social media for ages. Oh, that's going to be really bad. That means the podcast's going to fail. Then I have got Eleni awake and I'm trying to do some prep for my radio show and she's crying and I'm like, oh no, but I need to do this prep because I've got to do my radio show. But I also then feel like I'm not being a very good mum to her. And I feel like I am just giving and giving and pouring out of me and giving everything that I have got and I'm a bit empty.
Do you know what? You saying this is so much more important than people thinking you're smashing motherhood and smashing all the other things that you're doing, because it's the reality, isn't it? Daily, I look at Instagram and go, oh my God, look at that activity they're doing with their toddler. Oh, look at this that they're doing. Oh my God, look how happy they look. They're really doing so well. And I can't think of anything to do today. And I don't actually want to go for another walk and have to wash the puddle suit again and clean him up and try and think of another activity to do. Reality is important. And like you say, obviously it's difficult when we're about to enter an interview where we're talking to somebody who unfortunately hasn't been able to have a child. And yes, we are extremely grateful for the position we're in. But at the same time, it is really important for everybody listening to hear every angle. That's what the podcast is about. You need to let out the negative as well. Like, we all have these days.
This is the other thing that I think, because of lockdown and because of everything else that's going on in the world, you're not getting those little fixes, those little boosts to you. So I can't pop over to yours for a cup of tea. I can't nip round to mum's and say, mum, can you watch Eleni for a bit? Because I'm struggling. I need to get some work done or I need to have a sleep. Like, I can't do any of those things. And so I feel like I'm just going a bit mental.
But I think that is so relatable. Like, I can't tell you how much, like, I've just missed being able to go to a mate's and have a cuppa.
I need more than a cup of tea at the minute.
Well, I can't have anything more than a cup of tea at the minute. Oh, so. Shit,
yeah.
No, I had a McChicken sandwich today. So that was my moment.
Well, what we can all learn here is you got to do what you got to do to survive this shit, be it a glass of red wine or a chicken sandwich.
Absolutely.
I'm Sheridan Voysey. I'm married to Merin. We have been married as of just a couple of days ago. We have been married 24 years and we're in the not parenting status after a very long journey trying to become parents.
24 years is some going.
You get more for murder. Is that what they sometimes say? You get less for murder. I think that's how the joke goes, something along those lines. Yeah, and we're going really well. We've had some really difficult journeys to do, and we've walked through some pretty horrible forests. But, you know, we've come out into some good sunshiny, beautiful areas and some lovely vistas, if you want to, you know. I really can't push the metaphor too much beyond that. But we're doing all right. We're doing all right.
Okay, so let's rewind 24 years. So you're getting married. At this point, have you discussed like wanting to have children? What was your kind of position?
You know, before we got married, I can't remember we actually had the conversation about children specifically, which I know is a bit of a no-no. You know, lots of people say, well, it's one of those things you really should be talking about before you get married so that you're on the same page. I think the reason why we didn't is because we just assumed that was what was going to happen, that it was just going to be a part of our future because, let's face it, that's the future for most couples. Isn't it? Unless they specifically choose not to have children. It generally is. It's what you generally do. So we were then married for a good 4 or 5 years before we finally had the discussion in the kitchen one day. And we'd talked about children before, but Merin had said in that conversation, she said, honey, I think it's time. And she was right because we had been running around from city to city by that stage, and now we were in a much more settled situation. It was the time to start thinking about children. I had never been particularly driven to have children. I was happy either way, but, you know, I was kind of happy to go along with it. And so we made the decision that we would, you know, start trying for a family. And like any couple knows who makes that decision, every 28 days from that point on, you are looking for signs of success, and there is expectation. And very commonly, that first month is followed by disappointment. And then you have another month, and there's expectation. And very commonly, that month is followed by disappointment. And very commonly after that, for many couples, the expectation, the third month is followed with excitement. Well, for us, the pattern went expectation, disappointment, expectation, disappointment, expectation, disappointment, expectation, disappointment. And after 9 months, we went and got some tests done. And those tests revealed that there was a problem on my side, biologically a significant problem. And without, you know, some kind of divine miracle or technological assistance, our dreamt of child would not be coming along to us anytime soon. So that then got us started on what was then a very, very long journey of trying all sorts of methods, all sorts of avenues to have our dreamt of child.
If you don't mind me asking, what was the kind of diagnosis? What was the issue, if you like?
Yeah, very low sperm count and then very low quality of sperm. And there's lots of technical names for it, but ultimately that was it. They were just very low quality sperm and very little of them. And so that meant that when it came to doing IVF and things like that, we really only had one option, which was ICSI, intercytoplasmic sperm injection. So they take specifically grab a single sperm and inject it into the egg and then cultivate those for a little while and then put those blastocysts then back into the woman at a later stage. And that was really the only option for us. And we went through several rounds of that.
So presumably at that point, you've been trying for a while and you're not, like you say, getting to the end of that 28 days and seeing a positive on a stick. You go for these tests. How did you feel when they then said, you know, there is a problem for starters and also that the problem lay with you?
So right back at the early days, when we got the initial diagnosis. Because the results were actually so bad, the doctor at first said, you know, I think that there's been a problem here, so we'll get you to do another test. And so when the second test came back and it was, I think, if not as bad, it might have even been a little bit worse, that's when it really hit. And there was a sense of, now we've got a huge problem ahead of us. There was that kind of sense of dread, actually, as to this is not going to be as simple and straightforward as it is for almost everybody else. And why have we been picked out to be the ones that have to focus on this? In terms of any big threat to my masculinity, the interesting thing was it wasn't so much that for me. And that is largely because I never felt very much like a masculine man anyway. I was born in Australia to British parents, and I was born in Brisbane, Queensland. And Brisbane, Queensland, very much to be a male Brisbaneite means that you're an outdoorsy guy. You like football, you like beer, you like women, and you're not really
into all of that.
Exactly. It's the whole lad thing. And so I had never fit into that. I'd had a slight English accent because of being raised by two Brits, even though I was born in Australia. So I didn't fit in there. I was always the tallest in my class. I was lanky. So I never really connected with being a bloke in Australia. So funnily enough, it actually gave me something of a barrier. It didn't hit me at my masculinity because I never felt particularly like an Australian male anyway. What really was the problem is as the journey went on, I felt incredibly guilty that I was the reason why Meryn couldn't have what she desperately wanted. And particularly as the years rolled on for us, it was a 10-year journey for us in the end. Particularly towards the end when you might have night after night after night that you are holding your sobbing wife because this is a really difficult journey and you're the biological reason why she can't have what she wants. And you didn't choose it. It's not your fault, but you still feel guilty about that. That was the hardest bit for me.
Do you know what? I can't even imagine how hard that would be. From what I know from people who particularly, like you say, if you've had years of trying to conceive, it's highly emotional anyway. And so how much of a strain did it put on your relationship?
Very good question. We were sitting in, when we first started looking at IVF, we had a meeting with an IVF counsellor. And we were sitting in this room, two chairs, and she was sitting opposite us. And she said, we should talk about marriage and the stress that IVF puts on marriage, etc. And we said, oh, okay, yep, that would be good for us to talk about. And we just assumed that she was talking about the drugs, because when you're going through IVF, the drugs really throw the woman into an emotional roller coaster, you know.
Yeah.
It's absolutely, you know, crazy. And that can actually put a lot of pressure on a marriage. And actually said, no, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about decision making. I'm talking about when you're not on the same page as to how many rounds you're going to do. And when one member of the marriage gets to a point where they say, yeah, okay, I'm done with this. And the other one says, no, I want to keep on going for as many times as it takes. We faced that on a number of occasions. I would have been more than happy to have wrapped up our journey at least 5 years earlier. But I kept on going because of Meryn and because, you know, I was the reason why. And also when we looked into adoption too, we were often on different pages when it came to, do we go local? Do we go overseas? For a while, we were looking at the Philippines adopting internationally, which that program is now closed anyway. But we were looking at that and, you know, we were just on different pages so often. And yet Meryn said to the counselor in that counseling room, she said, well, we've already talked about that. And we've already decided that our marriage is more important than having a child, and that if the journey to have the child gets in the way of our marriage, well, then we'll call it quits. And, you know, Naomi, the counselor literally, she slumped in her chair and she said, I am so glad to hear you say that, because just yesterday a couple sat in the very same chairs that you're sitting in now. And the woman said to me in front of her husband, if we don't have a child, this marriage is through. And I think that's when we realized just the pressure that this journey can put on marriages. And we didn't want to go down that path. And I really would say to any couple, who is wrestling with this journey, please make the same commitment, because if you don't, you'll have a second loss.
So you might have noticed during this interview that Sheridan is pretty amazing at speaking. Like, I feel like I'd like to listen to him all day.
Isn't he just?
Yeah. And I love the way he always says your name.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
really, it's really personal and nice. I like it.
He's lovely. He's a good guy.
He is. And not only is he an amazing speaker, but he's also an amazing writer, isn't he?
Indeed. We mention basically that the book that he wrote about his experience with infertility originally was Resurrection Year, Turning Broken Dreams into New Beginnings. But then there's The Making of Us, Who We Can Become When Life Doesn't Go As Planned. So if you enjoy this interview and you're like, I want me some more Sheridan Voicey in my life, then you can get some sweet bargains on Amazon.
Great accent.
So, you know, here we are. We try for 10 years. We try special diets. We try IVF, numerous rounds of IVF. We go through the process of being assessed and trained for local adoption in New South Wales, Australia. We were living in Sydney at the time. So that was something like an 8-month process. We then wait for 2 years on the adoption list, and we never get the phone call. So then we go and try more rounds of IVF, deciding we will do as many rounds as it takes to get our dreamt of child. We had tried chiropractic, Naomi. I don't know why we tried chiropractic, but somebody said that might work. We tried special, we tried healing prayer. We tried all sorts of things. And would you believe that, you know, at the very end of that journey, on our last embryo transfer, and this is by the time Marin and I had already had the conversation and said, if this doesn't work, this is our last embryo, this has been 10 years, if this doesn't work, we are moving on as a childless couple. And would you believe it was on that final embryo that we had a call from the IVF clinic saying, you're pregnant. And there was eruption of joy and celebration from all our family and friends who had been journeying with us for a decade in this. And then on Christmas Eve, a couple of weeks later, we had another call from the IVF clinic saying we are so, so sorry, because it had only been basically a false positive because the IVF drugs had created a gestational sac, but there was no body in the sac. And with that, Marin had put the phone down. She'd climbed onto our bed, curled up in a fetal position, and that is where our dream of having a child ended. So all of that.
Oh, my God. That breaks my heart.
You see the promised land, and then you realize you're barred from entering it. It's easily the darkest moment of our lives.
So you said this went on over 10 years. Within that 10-year period, like, how optimistic were you that it was gonna happen for you?
So we would have seasons, kind of like a pendulum swing. You know, the pendulum would swing up this way and we would kind of go, okay, yeah, we want to have children. Let's go and find the next thing to do. And then we would go and do that for a period of time. And then, you know, it wouldn't work. And the pendulum would swing the opposite end. And we would say, you know what, maybe we're just supposed to be a childless couple and just kind of live our life and take advantage of the fact that as a childless couple, you know, we've got lots of freedom and freedom to travel and freedom to do all sorts of careers, and we could work overseas and a whole bunch of things that we could do. And then, of course, a few months later, then the pendulum would start swinging the other direction. As far as optimism is concerned, I think particularly as it went on, it wasn't so much optimism or pessimism. We felt hope. I think it was just a constant sense of mystery, actually, rather than either optimism or pessimism. We were still planning ahead. In fact, you know, by the end of that 10 years, if you had come into our Sydney flat and walked into the kitchen, you would have seen a stroller and a pram ready. And if you had gone into the laundry, you would have found a play rug all wrapped up and ready to be unwrapped and used. So I guess you could say to some degree we were dreaming and we were planning towards that end. And I think with adoption, there was always that sense in which, well, there's so many kids that need adoption, adopting, aren't there? Well, there are a lot of kids who need fostering. And I hope that that might be on the possibilities list for somebody listening too, because there is such a huge need, particularly here in the UK, for foster parents right now. But then legally, we just, there are very small, in New South Wales at that time, there are a very small amount of children who legally were actually available for adoption. So as time went on, we became numb, Naomi. I think that's probably the thing. Mm. It wasn't optimism or pessimism. It was just a certain degree of numbness, but we will still work ahead and try and make this dream come to reality.
How did you find the adoption process? Because obviously you're saying there that actually the number of possible children who would be up for adoption was actually very small. Like, when you were doing it, did you feel like you were kind of fully informed of like how the process might pan out, or?
Yeah. So in the New South Wales system, it wasn't a list in terms of, okay, you're in the queue and, you know, you're ninth in the queue and then suddenly you're eighth and then you're seventh and, you know, the next phone call you're going to get. It was a pool. And you were almost selling yourself, I think, to the birth mum, because generally it was the birth mum who was, you know, who was putting the child up for adoption. But you never knew how many birth mothers were seeing your profile. You did up this kind of 2 or 3 page profile, basically talking about who you were and your background and what your, you know, what your dreams and hopes would be for the child and how you would raise them and everything. And because of confidentiality rules, and appropriately so, but still incredibly difficult for, we found that we weren't told any information. Was it that a whole bunch of these birth mothers were reading our profiles and saying, oh, I don't like that couple? Or was it the fact that there was one birth mum coming along in 2 years because that's all that were coming through the system and they were looking at somebody else and the child went to somebody else? You just never knew. And it was that sense of complete mystery that was the disempowering thing.
When you went through the kind of application process, I suppose, for it, do they say to you, oh, well, is it a case of how long is a piece of string as to how long it may or may take and it may never happen?
So the same social worker was assigned to us for looking at either overseas adoption or local adoption. And at first, we were still talking about the Philippines option and adopting from overseas. And so we were going through the first few weeks of the assessment based on that. And then there was a conversation that we had with the social worker, and she said, you know what, so many people are looking at overseas adoption. That meant that there's fewer parents to be applying for local children. And so as a result of that conversation, we ended up switching to go local. And, you know, you've always got those what if questions, don't you? What if we had kept on going and we had pursued the Philippines option? And I do remember when we had finally finished the 8 months assessment, the social worker was such a lovely woman. I don't in any way fault her for this, but she said as she was leaving the door, she said, look, I really shouldn't say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. You're a really lovely couple. I don't think it's going to take long until you're placed with a child. Just wait for the phone call. And the problem was, of course, that 2 years later, the phone call still hadn't come.
I've got a stat here about adoption in the UK. Apparently, there are 6,000 children that come up for adoption in the UK every year. I can't believe there are that many.
No, that is unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah. A lot of them are school age, apparently, and 50% are brother and sister.
Yeah.
That makes me sad.
It all makes me sad.
Yeah, true. That is true.
Although, I say it makes me sad, actually, in a lot of situations, this could be the best possible thing for them.
Well, it can absolutely be a positive thing because we had lovely Helen on the last series who she adopted a little boy, and by the sounds of it, they're having a flipping lovely time together. And as Sheridan said in his books and in this interview, you can create new beginnings and positive things for it. So if you are considering adoption or you are looking for a bit of advice, then Camilla, where can we go?
So there are lots of different websites, but a good place to start would be adoptionuk.org.
So after you'd made the decision before you even had that last round of IVF, but how was it then, like you say, after the dust had settled, did it feel completely closed, or was there ever part of you that was like, was there ever a wobble on it?
Yeah, very, very good question. Really important. For me, it was a sense of relief because finally Merin had caught up with where I wanted her to be. Like I said before, I would have been happy to have ended the journey 5 years before. So the fact that then Merin felt, okay, now I'm ready to move on. We tried everything and we've got to move on with our lives. I was really, really glad about that. When we moved to the UK, the only other thing that Merin had wanted to do with her life, apart from become a mum, was to work overseas. And so when she was offered a job at Oxford University, we saw that as the kind of consolation prize that she could have. And so we made the move over here. That was a real challenge for me personally, because things were going really well for me career-wise in Australia. I was hosting a national radio show at that stage that itself had been a 10-year dream come true. I had publishing contracts, speaking engagements, lots of really good things were going on for me. And I knew that when I moved to another country, all of that would dry up, and I didn't know for how long it would dry up. It turned out to dry up actually for a few years. And so that really hit my identity because of the career side of things. But when we moved over, we met a couple actually in a church that we're a part of, and they had these two lovely kids. And one by that stage was in his early teen years, and the other girl, she would have been at the time, would have been maybe 6 or 7. She was most darling girl, and I had always wanted a daughter if I was going to have a child. And they said, well, we adopted these kids, and both of them, they had gotten like within 2 weeks of being assessed and being approved. 2 weeks. And that got us thinking again, hang on, maybe things are different here. Maybe. And you know what? It started the whole process around again. And we actually had to put an end to it, because it was like, oh, we can't go through this again. We can't open up. It's like we had buried the dream and then we were kind of digging up the casket to bring out the corpse. I went and had a conversation with a friend of mine who knew all about the process, and we discovered that actually it was really, for most couples, it's actually about the same as what we experienced in New South Wales. 8-month assessment, and then you wait for the phone call. And I actually said to Merin, you know what? I've got to be honest with you. I kept on going that last 5 years because I really wanted to give you what you wanted. Honestly, I can't go through this again. And my wife, bless her, said, okay, I'm not going to ask you to.
So how far down the line are you now from that moment of that Christmas of this is the end now?
Yeah, well, that was Christmas of 2010. So We then had another few months of kind of working out, well, what are we doing? Where are we going? And then the job offer came through January of 2011. And then we made our way over to here to the UK June of 2011. And so, yeah, we're quite a few years on. And what we find is the time between the tears gets longer. And that's a sign of how you're healing. And so, you know, for the first few weeks, you know, Merin was crying, you know, once every couple of days. And then it moved to, well, once a week. And then it moved to once every month and once every 3 months. And now, you know, it's not a living, pursuing issue for us. It's not a day-to-day grief for us now. We have been able to heal and we've been able to move on with our lives. That doesn't say that every now and then we're not reminded of what we don't have. I kind of describe it as kind of having, we used to have a big flesh wound on our arm. Well, now that flesh wound has healed up, but there's still a scar. And every now and then you're walking along and somebody will bump into your arm and you realize, oh, ouch, that hurts. That's why, because I've still got a scar. And so there will be times still when I'll, you know, see a father playing with his daughter in the playground and I'll say, oh, you know, it's a shame I can't have that. Or actually for a good deal of my friends now, those children are now getting married. And I've been told that actually the next grief comes when they start having children. And so when you and all your friends are becoming grandparents and you're not becoming a grandparent, we haven't faced that yet. In terms of the grief, a number of my friends have actually become grandparents quite early. We haven't faced that grief yet, but, you know, all that is to say, you can find a healing journey that can get you into a really good place.
Oh, that is a really lovely way of putting it. One thing I was going to ask you is, so obviously you opened, not only did you open up about your experience, you opened up quite spectacularly about your experience in a book and have since gone on to talk very openly and done lots of interviews. So lucky us that we get to have you as well. But how did it feel when you felt like you could talk more openly about this experience? Because like we said at the start, that is one thing, particularly with male infertility, that it seems like it's so far behind where the kind of female side of the trying to conceive community is at.
Yeah, there is so much shame involved in infertility and men. Even if they're not the biological cause, there is so much shame because we still have in our culture a sense that your masculinity is proved when you have sired a child. And, you know, all of our jokes are always, I knew you had it in you, mate, you know, that kind of stuff. And so it all reinforces this idea that your masculinity is proved once you have sired a child. Well, what happens if you can't? And what happens if it's not even your biological fault? Actually, the problem is on your wife's side. Will you still feel it because you are still taught that this is the mark of your masculinity? This is one of the reasons why so few men want to go public with it. The only reason why I have is because, you know, this is never the topic I wanted to go. I never wanted to be the infertility guy. It wasn't the brand I wanted, Naomi.
Yeah.
But, you know, the reason why is because of what we kind of mentioned a little bit earlier in our conversation about that sense of, well, I never felt like this big blokey Brisbane man anyway, so there was nothing much to lose. And secondly, once I did, then the healing that happened for people was a reward in itself. I will get emails from guys who will say, I have never shared this with anybody. And these are complete and utter strangers. I've never shared this with anybody. Nobody else knows. And I feel so isolated and so alone. And you know, the other thing, Naomi, is that often wives haven't actually asked their husbands how they're feeling about this journey either. And I think that's been the other touching thing, is that by people reading Resurrection Year and The Making of Us, is that some people say, you know what? I've never asked my husband how he is feeling about this journey. Because again, often it's assumed that infertility is a woman's issue. Mm. And the man is just the stoic guy who's, you know, coming alongside and is just going to be the rock in the midst of the storm. Some of these guys desperately want to be dads. And because they can't be dads, there's all sorts of existential crises going on, but they may not necessarily have told you that. So, you know, I hope even our conversation stimulates a few of those gentle conversations to open up that guy to talk about how he's feeling about this journey. A few years ago, I think it was University of Lancaster or one of the universities did the first, and that's telling by itself, the first piece of qualitative research about men and infertility. And they found that infertility affects a man's sense of identity, his sense of purpose, often affects his career, affects his income levels, and has all sorts of challenges to his self-esteem. And here's the thing. Why had nobody done that research before? We have got mountains of research on the effects of infertility on females, and I'm glad we do. But why was this the first? So the fact is that there's a whole bunch of really hurting men out there, and they're sitting beside us on trains and in the buses, and they're in our families, and then they're our circle of friends, and they just need somebody really to be a caring presence there to be able to open up to in time.
Isn't he just lovely?
He really is.
I could listen to him talk for ages. I can totally see why he is a successful speaker and has a history in radio, because he's just lovely to listen to.
He is. Maybe we should just do a whole series with Sheridan. or you could just kick me off and he can become your sidekick.
Well, you never know. Mill, if your baby comes early, Sheridan, if Step Camilla's up. Baby comes early, you can come and be my co-host.
Just don't be too good, Sheridan. Don't, you know. But getting back to the interview, a bit more serious. Shocking that there is like not a lot of research for male infertility. You know, he was saying they're poles apart in the amount of info you can get about female infertility in comparison to male.
Yeah. And did you watch the Chris Hughes TV program, Mill, with him and his brother about male fertility?
I didn't, and I really need to watch it.
Shut up.
No, I know. It passed me by and I kept wanting to watch it on iPlayer and then I forgot.
Oh my God. Well, I hope that it's still on iPlayer. Right, I'm going to have a look if it's still on iPlayer. Hang on.
I love him because, as well. He's so funny.
Because genuinely, it was such a good TV program. It was so insightful. And I almost feel like it should be shown in schools so that people understand from a young age that it is not just women who need to think about having a baby or not. Me, My Brother and Our Balls, it was called.
That's it.
8 months left to watch on BBC iPlayer. Me, My Brother and Our Balls, if you haven't watched it, oh my God, it's absolutely so super insightful into infertility. But it's kind of, the point is that as well as the fact that there's not loads of research out there, there's not loads of people talking about it. There's understandably with any infertility stuff, there's a shame and there's a stigma around it, but particularly with the male infertility stuff. So extra hats off to Sheridan for chatting to us about it. But yeah, genuinely, if you've listened to this and you're like, God, I just need to find out a bit more, Me, My Brother and Our Balls, iPlayer, sort
yourself out.
I'm going to watch it tonight.
I've decided now.
Oh, you'll love it as well. It's Chris Hughes.
I know, I love him. I watched him on the thingy on ice for cancer research.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my God, I love him. He's so funny. I mean, he's a bit stupid, but in the nicest possible way.
Oh, defo. And one of my favourite bits in it, so sorry, spoiler alert, if you're going to watch the TV programme, and definitely still watch it. But the reason they did the TV programme is because his brother has infertility issues. Mm-hmm. And the only reason his brother found out was after Chris Hughes went on This Morning. Yep. And got his balls out on the telly. And that's when he checked and found that there was something wrong with him. He'd never looked before that.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
So, lads, if you're listening, cop a feel.
Absolutely. Boys.
Honestly.
Check your balls.
I don't know if you can enter the podcast or check your balls.
Check your balls.
Follow my journey and tell us about your own on social media. We are at To Baby or Not. If you rate and review this podcast, not only will it really help us out, but it'll mean that if you are ever going to get bad news, it will never come on Christmas Eve.
On To Baby or Not To Baby.
They said, and what we've done is we've done some histology of it. We've, you know, sliced it and looked it under a microscope. We're really sorry to say that it's cancer.